Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, November 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. and Israeli officials say negotiations are underway to release hostages kidnapped by Hamas.
Not going to comment live on air about sensitive negotiations. We hope to get them home. We're doing everything we can to bring them home. And the less we say, the better and the more likely we will be to secure their release.
Meanwhile, the UN says two of its schools sheltering over 10,000 people in Gaza were attacked over the weekend. Liberians welcome President Weah's concession as a strength of their democracy. More than 1 million people die in road accidents each year globally. The DRC announces the deployment of SADC forces.
Not a single foreign forces will bring peace to the DRC. DRC will have to organize herself to defend herself.
And remembering former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, who died yesterday at age 96. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. and Israeli officials say there are ongoing negotiations to bring about the release of the hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7, but Israeli officials refused to give details due to what they called the sensitive nature of the negotiations. VOA's Peter Clotte spoke with Israeli government spokesperson Ilan Levy about this and other developments.
I'm not going to comment live on air about sensitive negotiations. You'll understand that human lives hang in the balance. 240 hostages, including over 30 children, including 10 toddlers under the age of five. There's a 10-month-old baby who is now being held hostage by Hamas in a dark tunnel somewhere. So we hope to get them home. We're doing everything we can to bring them home. And the less we say, the better and the more likely we will be to secure their release.
Well, Israel says it has uncovered a Hamas command center, tunnels and ammunition at the Shifa hospital. Some of the doctors are denying, and Hamas is also dismissing the finds. What's the Israeli government's reaction to these denials?
Look, the fact that Hamas denies it is not surprising. Hamas denies that it perpetrated the atrocities of October 7th. Hamas denies that it took civilians hostage. Hamas denies that its fighters have been killed. Hamas denies everything, okay? Hamas is not a credible source for anything. Now, as for the doctors inside the hospital, you have to understand, perhaps they're good people. I don't dispute that. But they are living under an authoritarian regime. Hamas is an authoritarian regime that dictates what people are allowed to say freely. And they know that they are not free to speak freely. And so whether or not those doctors are supporting Hamas, and the evidence shows that actually Hamas enjoys vast support among the Palestinian public, those doctors are not free to speak their minds. So the fact that they're not telling us, look, there's a Hamas compound in the basement, is not surprising. What I can confirm, we are revealing the evidence, we're exposing the evidence. This isn't the Wizard of Oz that we can pull back a curtain and say, ta-da, here is the whole vast Hamas tunnel complex. They've spent 16 years building these headquarters. They've had a month to prepare for us coming, and we will peel back the evidence and present it for the whole world to see.
Israeli government spokesperson Ilan Levy was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, has welcomed the Israeli government's approval of fuel delivery from humanitarian operations in Gaza on Saturday. However, the agency says the delivery is only half of the daily fuel required for humanitarian operations in Gaza. In another development, UNRWA spokesperson Julia Tuma tells me that two of their schools sheltering more than 10,000 people were attacked over the weekend. Israeli authorities were not immediately available for comment.
We received confirmation that two UNRWA schools have been hit in 24 hours. One of them is the second time that it's been hit, and both of them were sheltering more than 10,000 people when they were hit. We don't have confirmation on the number of people killed or injured as a result, but it is believed to be in the dozens.
Juliet, we don't have confirmation also from the Israeli army, but do they know that these institutions you are talking about, they are your institutions? Does the Israeli army know that?
So UNRWA shares coordinates of all our facilities across the Gaza Strip with all parties to the conflict. We do that on a regular basis.
So they should know that these are your institutions and they are sheltering people.
Yes, because we share coordinates of all our facilities with all parties to the conflict.
And have you told the Israeli army of this latest incident?
I mean, we put out a statement about it.
What's the latest now? Because when we last spoke, you were complaining about the need for fuel, constant right. supply of fuel. Where are we now?
So we finally got some fuel just yesterday. 120,000 liters were sent to Gaza. UNRWA received them after long and lengthy for weeks on end. And we finally got a much needed shipment of fuel. However, the shipment covers only half of our daily needs. And we need to have more fuel coming in. We need to have fuel coming in on a regular basis without any conditions for UNRWA and other humanitarian organizations to be able to continue their work.
I don't know whether this impacts you, but the negotiations are underway, according to reports here, for release of the hostages. Does that impact you?
What we are calling for, James, is a ceasefire, is a humanitarian ceasefire, as soon as possible for the sake of civilians wherever they are. We are entering week 7 of this war, and the human toll on all sides has been huge, including on UNRWA staff. We have 104 colleagues who have been killed during this war. This is what we were able to confirm, and the number is likely to be higher.
Julia Tuma is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, spokesperson. She spoke with us from Amman, Jordan. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, has now announced that Southern African Development Community SADC forces will be deployed in the country in a few days. Moses Heavyerimana reports.
Last Friday, the presidency of DRC announced that President Felix Antoine Tshisekedi officiated at the signing of an agreement between DRC and the Southern African Development Community to deploy their forces in the Congo. According to Kinshasa, SADC, a regional bloc of 16 countries, will deploy its troops with the mission of supporting the Congolese army in combating the M23 rebels and other armed groups. DRC President Felix Tshisekedi, during an interview with the French media, accused Rwanda of being the root cause of the instability.
He says that
M23 is an empty shell and that there are really Rwandan defense forces who are fighting. He says that his government has all the proof and images of their presence. Kigali has repeatedly denied the allegations. Rwanda's government spokesperson told VOA's James Batty that the deployment of another regional force does not address the root cause of what she calls a long-standing security and government failure of the DRC government. Kinshasa has delayed the renewal of the mandate of the East African Community Regional Forces, which is set to expire in December. The signing of the deployment of SADC forces has sent mixed signals. Peter Matuki is the Secretary General of the East African Community.
A restoration of peace and security in Eastern DRC was decided by the members of the summit will be done through two tracks, the political track and military track. Military track is now the presence of the East African Regional Force. The second track, which is the political track, is being handled by a facilitator who was appointed last year.
According to the East African Community, a report from the facilitator, Kenya's former president Uhuru Kenyatta, will be handed to the heads of state summit, which is expected to take place on Friday in Arusha, Tanzania. Dr. Nkere Ntanda is a political science professor at the University of Kinshasa.
Not a single foreign forces will bring peace to the DRC. DRC will have to organize herself, to organize her army, to organize her security, to defend herself. So SADC won't make any difference at all.
Last Friday, President Tshisekedi had an online meeting with the President of Kenya and Uganda, William Ruto, and Yoweri Museveni, on the security situation in DRC. Despite the resumed conflict in the eastern part of DRC, the country is expected to hold general elections next month. Moses Havyarimana for VOA Africa.
Yeah. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, November 20th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson Omalley's Horse. Liberians in and outside of Liberia are welcoming the concession speech of incumbent President George Weah following his defeat to opposition leader Joseph Boakai in the country's November 14 runoff election. Denise Nepson reports from Monrovia.
The National Elections Commission of Liberia, also known as NEC, will today, Monday, officially declare the winner of the vote. Incumbent President George Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change, CDC, on Friday accepted defeat and congratulated former Vice President Joseph Boakai of the United Party, UP.
The results announced tonight, though not final, indicate that Ambassador Joseph Nima Boakai is in a lead that we cannot surpass. A few moments ago, I spoke with President-elect Joseph Nima Boakai to congratulate him on his victory. Tonight, as we acknowledge the result, let us also recognize that the true winners of these elections are the people of Liberia.
Saturday's provisional results announced by the NEC showed Boakai at 50.64% and we are at 49.36%. Some Liberians have been speaking to VOA about the outcome of the election and President Weah's concession statement. Amos Moe says, although he is not a supporter of the CDC, President Weah's acceptance of the results is a good sign that Liberia democracy is getting stronger.
To wear fan or Tinder in Africa is very difficult. To see your president accept it is very difficult in Africa to be wear. It shows that our democracy is improving on a daily basis. But at least we all went there and the president have done it for us. So actually, I must applaud him, even though I'm not a citizen, but what he did, wow. I'm so surprised. I'm shocked.
Another citizen, Isaiah Boto, says progressives should get credit for the trouble-free polls and peaceful transfer of power. He especially pointed to the influence of a late leader in Liberia's multi-party system and creator of the Progressive Alliance of Liberia in 1975.
The very first thing I felt that was good is that our democracy have grown to an extent that we are able to stand. And at the counting period, I started retrospecting the days of G. Bacchus Matthew and the rest of the patriarch that fought to bring about democracy.
Meanwhile, President-elect Joseph Boakai has yet to make an acceptance speech. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
An estimated 1.3 million people die each year across the world because of road traffic crashes. According to the World Health Organization, between 20 and 50 million more people suffer non-fatal injuries, with many incurring disabilities because of their accidents. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
Road traffic injuries cause considerably economic losses to individuals, their families, and to countries. A new United Nations report indicates that road traffic injuries are now the leading killer of people aged 5 to 29 years, costing countries 3% of their gross domestic product. Etienne Krug is the director of the Department for Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization. He says countries are still struggling to improve road safety despite actions taken by the organization.
We've been working on road safety for a while now at the global level, and I think we have improved awareness, we have improved the desire to take action, and in some countries we really see action. But unfortunately, we're still at 1.3 million deaths every year on our roads. Road traffic crashes continue to be the leading cause of death for young people in almost every country around the world.
The UN says road fatalities are closely linked to poor infrastructure, unplanned urbanization, limited road safety literacy, and persistent inequalities both within and between countries. WHO says driving under the influence of drugs, distracted driving, unsafe vehicles, and inadequate law enforcement of traffic rules are the major causes of accidents on the roads. Krug says age is not a major problem when it comes to accidents on the roads.
The major problem is excessive speeding, drink driving, non-use of seatbelts or motorcycle helmets, the lack of infrastructure that is appropriate for vulnerable road users. Those are the bigger issues that can be solved.
More than 90% of road traffic deaths occur in low and middle-income countries. Road traffic injury death rates are highest in the African region. In Africa, traffic deaths account for about one quarter of the global number of victims, even though the continent has barely 2% of the world's vehicle fleet. In countries like Kenya, the number of accidents this year has increased by 4% compared to the same period last year. The chairperson of Kenya's National Transport Safety Authority, Agnes Odhiambo, says the country has embarked on a campaign to teach drivers how to reduce accidents as the festive Christmas season approaches. The WHO says more than half of all road traffic deaths are among vulnerable users, pedestrians, cyclists, and motorcyclists. The WHO calls on member states, the private sector, and the civil society to implement measures that will help reduce traffic deaths and ensure vehicle safety. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has died at the age of 96. VOA's Ken Fairbaugh, who extensively covered Rosalynn Carter's life and post-White House career, promoting global health and democracy with her husband, former President Jimmy Carter, has more.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter acknowledged the secret to her nearly 80-year-long marriage to President was space and respect.
We grew to respect each other. I respect what he could do. He would respect what I could do. And from then on, it's just been a really wonderful partnership.
Eleanor Rosalynn Smith Carter was born in Plains, Georgia on August 18, 1927, and lived in the small peanut farming town during the Great Depression.
I had a really wonderful childhood until I was 13 when my daddy died, and that was sad. But we were poor, but everybody else was poor. We didn't even know we were poor because we had food in the garden and we had a cow in the backyard with milk, and mother made all my clothes.
She grew up familiar with the son of a local peanut farmer, James Earl Carter Jr., better known as Jimmy.
When he was 16, for instance, a senior in high school, I was 13, his little sister's friend. I never ever dreamed I'd go with him.
But on a visit back to Plains in 1946, while attending the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, Jimmy Carter proposed.
When I asked Rosalynn to marry me the first time, she said no. That was in February, and it wasn't until May that she changed her mind and decided to get married.
They married in Plains on July 7th, 1946. Mrs. Carter followed her husband during his naval career and gave birth to three sons, John Jack Carter, James Earl Carter III, or Chip, and Jeff. Daughter Amy was born later in 1967. The family returned to Plains in 1953 to take over the Carter peanut farming business, which Mrs. Carter managed even after her husband decided to enter politics in 1962.
But he got up one morning, and instead of putting on his khakis to go to work at the farm supply business, he put on his Sunday pants. And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to see who's going to run for the state Senate."
After contesting the results of that election, Carter won, launching his political career that eventually carried them into Georgia's governor's mansion in 1970 and the White House in 1977. While campaigning to help get her husband elected, Mrs. Carter heard a similar concern from voters.
Every single day that I campaigned, I had somebody ask me what I would do for a mentally ill loved one.
As First Lady of the United States, Carter used her platform to advocate for mental health, forming a presidential commission to address the issue. She traveled the world the rest of her life, working to remove the stigma associated with those suffering from mental illness. President Carter encouraged his wife's prominent role in his administration and sought her counsel throughout his tenure. The hostage crisis in Iran contributed to Carter's presidential election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan in 1980, and the couple returned to Plains, Georgia in 1981 to plan their post-presidential life, which Jimmy Carter told her he wanted to be different.
I have an idea about what we can do with the rest of our life. He said we can have a place kind of like Camp David where we can negotiate a peace agreement. So that was the germ of the idea for the Carter Center.
Founded in 1982, the Carter Center today is one of the leading global nonprofit organizations, working to wage peace, fight disease, and build hope to underserved populations throughout the world. Under Rosalynn and Jimmy Carter's leadership, the Carter Center has monitored more than 100 elections, treated millions of people suffering neglected tropical diseases, and is on the verge of total eradication of guinea worm. Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter are the longest married presidential couple in U.S. history. As her husband entered hospice care toward the end of his life, the Carter family announced the former First Lady was suffering from dementia. She spent her final years alongside Jimmy Carter in the small town of Plains, where they were born and grew up nearly a century before. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. Begin the sports with women football, where Mamelodi Sundowns ladies of South Africa have won the CAF Women's Champions League trophy after defeating Morocco's Sporting Club Casablanca 3-0 on Sunday. A brace from top scorer Sokalake Refiliwe and Botumelo Rabale's strike earned the South Africans victory in Cote d'Ivoire as they reclaimed the title they relinquished last year. Sundowns' impressive run in Cote d'Ivoire not only seized them reclaimed the title they lost to AS Far last season, but they set a record of lifting the title without conceding a single goal en route to be crowned champions. In athletics, Ugandan's Jacob Kiplimo set a new world record in the 15 kilometers race with victory at the 2023 Zevenhengelop Seven Hills race in Ingemergen City, Netherlands on Sunday, November 19th. The 23-year-old long-distance Ugandan athlete crossed the finish line after running 41 minutes 05 seconds. Also a gold medalist at the 2023 World Cross Country Championships in Bathurst, Australia, and the New York City Half Marathon, Kiplimo came ahead of another Ugandan, Rogers Kibet. Kiplimo also set a world record during the Lisbon 2021 Half Marathon with 51 minutes 31 seconds. Kibet posted 42 minutes 44 seconds ahead of Kenya's Amos Seriem, who came in 43 minutes 07 seconds to settle for bronze. And now to volleyball, where Kenya Pipeline are the Confederation of African Volleyball Zone 5 champions after thumping Rwanda Revenue Authority 3-0 in the club championships staged on Sunday at the BK Arena in Kigali, Rwanda. This means the Oilers won the maiden CAVB Zone 5 club championship in a beautiful fashion by completing the double against the Rwandese after tormenting them earlier in the round robin format with a similar scoreline. The Windsor Pipeline, who are making their debut in the competition that started in 2019, complete a double against RRA, whom they had defeated 3-0 in the preliminary stage of the week-long event that came to an end on Sunday. In the third-place playoffs, Rwanda Patriotic Army overwhelmed their compatriots Rwanda National Police 3-1 to finish third. In boxing news, former WBA junior featherweight champion Ghanaian Isaac Dabwe was defeated by Nick Ball to claim a 12-round unanimous decision victory on Saturday. All three judges scored the fight for Nick Ball 119-108, 116-111, and 118-109 in the WBC featherweight title eliminator at the AO Arena in Manchester, England. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, November 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.